Thank you, and congratulations to Joseph and Victoria. Wonderful readings, wonderful po poems. So my poem tonight is called Passing Over. This afternoon, the bus was behind the child. The father was running and talking about work. The child was silent. The father started to shout, regardless its son's attention. Waiting for the next tired summer. The sky is still light blue. The bus is coming. Next stop is close. The glass of the bus's announcement becomes of a purple phosphorescence. The hand of the child goes through, passing over, feeding the bones of the youth. There was nothing there. The hand of the child could touch the wall. With great disappointment, he started to cry of happiness. Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you, Antonio. So next up, we have Roger and Greg.
Hello. Hi. Hi, everyone. My name is Roger Gregg. This is a poem I wrote 8 years ago. I used to know it off by heart, and I've tried my best to relearn it in the last couple of days, so fingers crossed. There we go. It's called The Clown at the Gates of Paradise. St. Peter stood by heaven's pearly gates, where an old circus clown was awaiting his fate, with holes in his hat and a bright red nose, no better than a beggar in tattered, torn clothes. A clown with a tear near one of his eyes, who cried when he laughed and laughed when he cried. Then he heard St. Peter call out his clown name, and he stumbled on up, his head humbled in shame. And Peter took out that big book of life and said, "Now, you old clown, let me get this right. For in this bright light, we shall see why you cried when you laughed and laughed when you cried. You were a loony goon, a bungling buffoon, with pies in the face and twisted balloons. You struggled to juggle a few worthless balls from a bag of old gags through a lifetime of falls. A fool who had failed in all that he tried, who cried when he laughed and laughed when he cried. Now other clowns, they made fortunes, puffed themselves up. They won grants and awards, gold medals and cups. Other clowns had power and towers with their name and TV shows that brought them great fame. And they used their big names to sell little white lies. Well, you cried when you laughed and laughed when you cried. No, you were never a loud clown who blew a great trump and treated the circus like a personal dump. Never a proud clown who would brag and boast about the poor souls you had grabbed and groped. You were mostly ignored and even despised, because you cried when you laughed and laughed when you cried. In the sawdust of sorrow, you planted a few laughs for penniless children who could never pay you back. And you ran round the ring for these tatty exiles with a bucket of confetti showering smiles. And you fought back the fear, and you kept hope alive. But you cried when you laughed and laughed when you cried. Yeah, you were a loser clown, the butt of jokes, stumbling and bumbling for poor homeless folks And you never stepped on your fellows to climb to the top. Like the sound of your shoes, you were just a big flop. So you died in the rain as you huddled outside. You cried when you laughed and laughed when you cried. Then Peter closed up that big black book and gave that old clown a long, hard look and said, "Now I know why you have the tear on your face. You mourn for your follies, your failure and disgrace." And looking back, he could see he had failed as a clown. He was turning to leave when his trousers fell down. Then he heard a creak as the gate swung wide. "Well, don't just stand there," Peter said. "Come on inside. Yay, old fool, come on, step on through. If there is a heaven at all, it's for clowns just like you. A clown with a tear near one of his eyes, who cried when he laughed, and laughed when he cried." Am I allowed to do a shameless plug? Shameless plug. I'm a friend of mine and I are doing a show next week in the Cat Club, the Cork Arts Theater. It's got spoken word and poetry in it and stuff, so... it's next week anyway. Plug, sorry, I have to do it. It's called From the River of Ghosts, and it's on in the Cat Club. It opens Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And Thursday and Friday, they're matinees, and then Saturday night, the 20th, is the closing night. So, thanks, anyway. Thank you.
Next up, we're going to go to Pam Campbell on Zoom.
Okay, this is a prose poem, and it doesn't have a title yet, so got to give this headless child a title at some point. Okay, the car pulls alongside me, slow-like, staying even of me. It's buff black, like my biscuit-cleaned Mary Jane's. I think it's Papaw come to carry me home, like he does most days when Mama loses me. But it isn't Papaw. This man is smiling like churchmen do when wading sinners to river baptisms. Smiles so big you can't see their faces anymore. Maybe he is a churchman come to take me home. The man stretches his arm out the window and opens his hand. In it is my favorite candy, orange slices. He says, "You sure are a pretty thing." I take one orange slice. His hand is soft. The orange slice is sweet in my mouth. He opens the car door and says, "I got more right here next to me." I take a step closer, but then this man grins wrong, grins in a way that whitewashes the Cardinals' cheer, cheer, cheer from the wide and empty street where no kids play or mama stand in doorways watching. Something stirs deep inside, says, "Run." Okay, thank you.
And next up, we have Adrienne Brock.
Hi. Sorry, normally if I stay for the open mic, I would stay till the end, but I have to go home early today, so I hope no one takes offense. I'm really sorry. The only thing you need to know is Xochicalli is the Aztec god of fire. This is called In the Comoras, April 2023. And then he went down to the shop in Dungarvan to find a map, but there was no map to be found in any of the shops, and so he was late. My lift and I listen, and my lift nods his head, his heel in his bumper, then kneeling down, then rubbing at a spot on his sneaker as if he forgot that it can't be polished. Other maps are found. We begin following the river. One compass doesn't work. My tea, embraced by the silvered surfaces and gaskets of a thermos, falls into the drink. On the hill, the rain starts, and we seek to make sense of the random gray in all directions. At a certain point, it just becomes a search for oxygen. At a certain point, it is all feeling and the fiber in the thighs. Pushing over rock and freeing ankles from the carcasses of heather that would keep us entwined with what has passed in stillness. I picture the volcano in Mexico. How my father and I were swimming over black sand. How the wave unexpected came over us and churned my light 7-year-old body into a space without breath, without up or down, until we surfaced at least 20 feet from each other. We stood and I could not recognize him for the new kind of panic on his face. The child me looking right past my father, who had to duck to enter most rooms. There he was small, submerged in sea, beneath the volcano, with a name lost to us at the shore's edge. A lion's breath of smoke overhead. My daughter asks again and again, if there are any volcanoes left in Ireland. Looking at the geological map of her home place, she sees the Devonian streaks of Burgundy up north where they were tossed and flaring and controlled burns across the south. Are volcanoes like wolves, she asks. Have they been here before? Did people make the volcanoes go away too? How do I know what contour lines Hephaestus might trace affectionately, or how Xaitecutli, shaking off his many names and crossing the ocean, might set the heather to blaze again, might make it whisper in quiet heat. I cannot know what they would do, collapsing map to earth. Like me, they would be strangers here, but we would all recognize the smell of fire. Thank you.
Adrienne was our 5-word challenge winner earlier on today. Did you collect your prize, Adrienne?
Yeah, I did.
Mighty magic. So next up on the open mic, we have Michelle Delay.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks so much to the guest poets. You were amazing. Really missed you the last few months, lads. It was kind of a very emotional time, actually. It's a lot in the pipeline, but actually I'm just going to read tonight a poem from a few weeks ago that I just really enjoyed writing, about a scary snooker ball. It's called Cue Ball for My Dad. Also, I will also have to scoot off after this, but I'm going to tune in on the way home on Zoom and listen to you on the way home, so I look forward to that. Cue Ball. A milk tooth, rock tumbled and polished, holds the room in a mirror hemisphere. Not half as humble as two hands cupping, but sharp as water waiting, badly bowled by boasting players claiming some control. In every game you could be conned by simple laws of physics. There's one way in which the water falls, how many holes are in your fist. The blunted tusk commands all predictions made, what force of my reserve is called, what's happening in his head. Eclipsing white planet, peel the panels from the walls, make those student satin curl around your ball. Crush us in your rolling eye, one scoop off the marble top, demolition ice cream wreck, adroitly drive the blind spot. The caliper's jaw spins 2 inches and 1/4 open, a season in his mother's womb, 4 fingers and the tummy's shaken, lean as his cue and stiff as competition. Table hasn't bent in 2, bowing backwards, ballerina stretching. The crack of the reds racked, a great break, the sip before the story. Potting 12 black back to back on the yellow, my father told me. You can see through this obstruction lying center in your path. You can see if you... imagine that the cue ball is made of glass. Gramila, Slán.
Next up, guys, can we have Patricia Walsh?
This is no sugar. Sorry. This is for anybody who's ever been in a bad relationship. Like you, it's kind of like a deck of cards. It's kind of like a deck of cards. You know, you start off with two hearts and a diamond, and the end you wish you had a club and a spade. It's called Swastika Soul. If you come around, let it be said, I never wanted you anyway. Why would I spend disbelief when I can still think about you? The fragrant stairs, the acid coffee breaks, contradictions being irrelevant, incongruities being swept the line to cement your party line. If I dispense with your teachings, I might be better off forging for arguments to suspend you with while you twist the reed verdatim. The colder it gets, the harder to fall, but you would never admit it, the fact that you were never slighted. The skin off my nose transplants any favours. A remembered hatred locks my heart against the window to minimise the damage of memory dripping against the colder. You have taken your place among the blessed, while I, alone, re-embellish the wound we dug together. Thanks.
Great poem, Patricia, but intro of the century. So next up, guys, we are going to go to Jeff Cottrell over on Zoom.
All right, I'm going to hit you with an oldie. This is a piece called Review of This Piece. Review of This Piece by Jeff Cottrell begins rather unimaginatively with a straightforward literalism that desperately wants to emulate the tone of an educated critic, using terms such as literalism and emulate for effect. By the second sentence, you realize you're in for some kind of postmodern self-reflexive parody, but Cottrell quickly undermines the formal tone by switching you to the second person for no reason. The piece carries on, quite aimlessly, dragging on with the same theme, with an overly complex sentence that runs on and on and on and on, with no apparent sign of its ever having been edited right down to its most tight and clear and efficient form of verbal expression, but rather choosing to be redundant through repetition, more repetition, and saying the same thing over and over in different ways. Then, finally, there's a shorter sentence. But the damage has been done, and Cottrell finds himself flailing at the end of his first paragraph, yearning for a clever closing remark to make a transition, but unable to come up with even a modestly catchy turn of phrase. At this point, Cottrell seems to be aware that he has shot his whole load in the first paragraph, and thus, for a cheap laugh, resorts to such crass, vulgar imagery as shooting one's load. Then, the attempts at clever self-reference continue, but without any real accomplishment. Like a starving man reaching for one solitary breadcrumb he knows won't help him, Cottrell throws in a poor simile. On top of that, his attempt at a metaphor is a pathetic wounded animal, and his penchant for clichés leaves something to be desired. Cottrell cops out with the smug trick of pointing out various literary techniques by using those very techniques, but even supposing that were funny, he ruins the stunt by explaining it openly. The worst part is there's no payoff. Where is this leading to? Does he really think changing the tone with rhetorical questions can save this mess? So, on to the second page, the piece continues, and Cottrell is once again just looking for filler. You almost get the impression that he's trying to stretch the whole composition out to a full 4-minute length in order for it to fit in with many of his other stories and monologues, but he can't do it because there just isn't enough substance behind the theme to sustain a piece of that size. And even if there were, Cottrell would be better off simply ending it right there and leaving his audience wanting more. But does he have that kind of restraint and self-awareness? Of course not. He just keeps on writing and writing and writing, wasting everybody's time with the same thing over and over and over and over, even though he's clearly running out of fresh ideas. Even when he does finally come up with something new, the grammar he uses is real bad. In conclusion, review of this piece is a formulaic and forgettable flop, complete with gratuitous alliteration. It's just another one of Cottrell's contrived, indulgent, overlong one-joke monologues without any real soul behind it. If only Cottrell had the courage to challenge himself and write something from the heart without being satirical or relying on a bag of clever but cold, shallow gimmicks, perhaps he could make some significant progress as a writer beyond the realm of Zoom open mic nights. Wow, I wrote this in 2007. And it says Zoom. Amazing how they do that. But alas, if this is the best he can come up with now, he is doomed to a lifetime of literary obscurity. And even if Cottrell is satisfied with that, the least he could learn to do is come up with better endings. Wait, I don't see any more. I guess that's it. Okay, that's it. That's a review of this.
Jeff, that was awesome. We thoroughly enjoyed that one. Thank you. So next up, we have Mona Lynch.
Thank you. How do you follow that? This is a poem about a man born in 1895, who in 1916 took the King's Shilling, joined the British Army, and became a social pariah, certainly with his siblings. I read it because it's coming out in Southward 2024. Sabbath ritual. He began his ritual with shoe polishing. Then, taking his cutthroat razor from its wooden case, he tugged the strop dangling from his hoop by the window. With controlled rhythm, he would stroke the razor up, tilt it on the way down, using the ball of his thumb to check. A satisfied surgeon. Placing it on the rigid wooden draining board, he would fill the rotund Toby mug with water hot from the kettle on the hob, lather the badger-haired brush on the lump of Lifebuoy soap. I had a father, but was sometimes fatherless, his nurturing diverted to his white-collared friend in a pint glass. Saturday nights he would spend drowning demons, horrors of war, survivor's guilt. Nevertheless, he rose early on Sunday morning to attend mass, mingle with neighbours, dance the dance. Candy-floss jowls sagged under shaggy brows. Grin, scrape, round the bends and skim the slopes. An equine toss in an avalanche of water. Job done. His youngest, his old Segosha, I'd approach, eager to see the finished job, watch the light caress his face, showing divots, blood-stained paper, a shaky hand.
Next up, guys, we have Catherine Ronan. If you wouldn't mind taking the microphone, please, Catherine.
I'm going to read a poem called Symphony. Half candle man, I worry about you as you worm yourself around others, fall back, searching for old skin in dead grey cells of childhood and empty halls. I see your fingers mixing fruit in a bowl, adding extra cherries and peel to be more exotic on the tongue, as if to understand desire. Broken teeth full of windows offer their lace skirts to you. Batons poise ready for release. Dreams roll down countrysides. We gasp in one lost note of split orchestras. We wait for your light, your flickering light, to symphony, and then we can all begin.
Ben Thompson, if you could make your way to the microphone, thank you.
I must be shrinking. When I was about 14, a family friend that I was very fond of died, and it was a novel experience for me at that age. I went to his funeral and I remembered his funeral, and almost a quarter of a century later I found myself living in North London, very near where he was buried, and I went up and found his grave with a friend. So this poem is about that. It's called Requiem for Dennis Butt. I woke because it was morning and because a child came in. I woke then and found myself a man looking at a child who had come in bearing her inheritance. A child's freedom of mourning. I was aware I touched a common thing, man looking at child, with a frightening thing, selfhood, that I should be here alive looking at a child. The dead don't see this, over us the flesh moves, like moss upon stones, we are the river. Do we contradict the dead, we living, they dead? The dead looked at their children and had eyes of life. We look on our children and will have eyes of death. We and the dead look together through life, through death. But why seeing here, now? Who? After 24 years, I came back to your grave. There were poems, music, a narration. Four friends carried the box to a wild place under a tree. Unchanged the wild place, the tree. I left, moved, moved again, grew up, moved, had children, moved again almost to that place where all that time your face and hands and feet had lain. Your arms, your ribs, the heart which gave up on you were lying perfectly still, and the clouds rolled over your grave. And for all you could hear, I was a cloud rolling over your grave. I bent down to tell you about all who had come after, but you were right. They were clouds, they were gone. Even on a bright spring day, sleet and rain appear. The living come in from the cold. But the dead, laid under trees, bear their chests to the rain, equally for the snow and the fingers of frost. Their arms lie open in acceptance. We, the living, have decided that the dead shall bear the rain. They go out without complaining, as though suddenly become brave. In the vault, light breaks. In the vault, rain collects. The rain falls, catching the light, which frowns out of the clouds like the eye of God, painting the child in the eye of the man. Light echoes between the objects of the universe, the ghost of matter painting the unreachable. All this light-painted world is not for the dead. Are they any more wrong than we are? Having lived and loved, they lie quietly under the flowers, not disturbing us with non-existence, accepting not our memories nor the remnants of love, but the long cold rain as light perpetual.
Ben, thank you so much for that. That was truly spectacular. We really loved that. So next up, guys, we're going to go to Zoom. We have Maggie Hull.
That was just beautiful. Made me think of Peter. I'm going to read Ballad of the Tempest by James T. Field, and I'll follow that with something that I've written. We were crowded in the cabin. Not a soul would dare to sleep. It was midnight on the waters, and the storm was on the deep. 'Tis a fearful thing in winter to be shattered in the blast, and to hear the rattling trumpet thunder, cut away the mast. So we shuddered there in silence, for the stoutest held his breath, while the hungry sea was roaring and the breakers talked with death. As thus we sat in darkness, each one busy in his prayers, "We are lost," the captain shouted as he staggered down the stairs. But his little daughter whispered as she took his icy hand, "Isn't God upon the ocean just the same as on the land?" Then he kissed the little maiden, and we spoke in better cheer, and we anchored safe in harbour when the moon was shining clear. Legend tells of an invisible red thread that connects us to those we are destined to meet. Illusion beckons cautiously for wind to follow. She is weeding the garden of sea for relics of a sunflower, bearing ships to sail for the seraphim. On her mast is written the numbers of a vision. Watch as we swim against the moon with solar vision, streaming tissue paper light, shadow casting in blue cup offerings. Turn the last photograph upside down and read leaves from a teacup. See shards of a nursery rhyme fade into story as every child begins life as a circle. Fly back, blackbird, fly. Dance through the dreaming from behind the waxing night while waning in weeping. See bodies shopping markets for magic beans trapped inside tin bottles made of glass. Watch the illusion of time play an SOS to plastic jellyfish made of glass as the lighthouse without light plays nursery rhymes to the eye, edit blinking thread strings of a red illusion. Yeah.
Thank you, Maggie. I also thoroughly enjoyed meeting your cat earlier in the middle of the guest reading. You were on the screen in the background, and there was a big orange cat.
Ah, yes. Yes, cat. He whenever I'm near the computer, he likes to take the screen.
He got a few glances out here anyway. So next up, guys, we have Sue Blue.
So, guys, I guess we all have one of these. I even think we should have one of these. It's called Magic Moment. The sky, pure blue. Over the mountain dale, breathtaking the view as we pause on the hill beside tall, dark fir trees, still panting from the cycle, my sister and I. So quiet the air and clear, voices rise from the farm below, tractor ploughs the field, children call to their mum. Neighbours talk in the lush front garden, a ball kicked down the path by a little girl laughing, her black dog barks. All these sounds conveyed by this amphitheatre, and above us circles a pair of buzzards, their proud cry echoing across the valley. This was the moment. My first time ever, struck by that flash of inspiration, that urge to write with no pen nor paper until I found tissue and lipstick to note this magic down. Squatting next to my bike, my inner voice shaped the words to such a lure they boggled both me and my sister. As we wheel down to the stables in silence together, the wind rustling our hair, I was in awe, still floating on that clarity, that feeling, that surge of initiation, a new poem born, and a poet ignited, burning, hooked.
So we have just three left now, guys. We have Alexandra. If you wouldn't mind coming to the mic, please, Alexandra.
So forget-me-not is a type of flower, and it comes in all different colors, but mostly in like a bluish purplish hue and tone. And this flower represents love, memories, and remembrance. So this flower has five petals, and in this poem, the five petals will each represent a different kind of topic in my life. So forget-me-not is the name of this poem. The petals of a flower, so colorful, so vivid. Each variation holds its own memories, a living mind of its own. My memories bloomed five petals. My flower bloomed five petals, a remembrance of broken ties. Forget-me-not, whispered my devoted petals. For I shall visit you through midnight memories to remind you of your broken ties, said my petals unmercifully. First petal, blood. I was only young when I left my home, my roots ripped right out of its soils, the memories of this pain hollow but never forgotten. But as time went on, the walls grew higher. I climbed for years, reaching for my family on the other side. I finally reached the peak. The sight broke me. I climbed so high while my family stayed grounded, all except for one. Grandma, you climbed for me. No one else but you, my treasure for eternity. And to the rest of my family, goodbye my petal, the petal of blood. Second petal, trust. I've made a few friends throughout this lifetime. Some were my saviors, while others wished my doom. Stabbed in the back by masked demons. The same demons have sewed and binded my broken heart. I pushed past those demons and never looked back. Goodbye, my petal, the petal of trust. Third petal, emotional safety. The breakable bond between a father and a daughter. As a child, I thought this bond is everlasting, but I was wrong. From security to uncertain love, I watched water turn to a toxic substance. Where his shine faded, so did our bond. The girl in me tried to save him, but failed. I cannot save a drowning man who doesn't want to be saved. Goodbye, my petal, the petal of emotional security. Fourth petal, home. This house was my home, full of joy, love, laughter. But now this house screams uncertainty. For one moment, the walls echo my joyful laughter. The next, you know, the same exact walls crush me with its negative words. My body feels safe here, but my soul craves for emotional safety. This house will never rebuild itself. It's too late for that now. Goodbye, my petal, the petal of home. Fifth petal, love. For most people, a home is represented by a place. My home was a person, the love of a dark angel. But this angel showed his true colors. He clipped my wings and I no longer felt like flying. This betrayal hurt the most. I ignored all signs of foreshadowing because I believed in the light in him. From victim, I was turned into the villain. But I know my truth and you know it too. I freed myself from your lies and my self-destruction. Goodbye, my petal, the petal of love. You are my balance, my stem, the one that kept me alive and upright. But I shall be my own stem now and I will grow another set of petals. Goodbye, forget-me-not, the flower of broken ties. You will be remembered for eternity as a reminder of the strength I possess to climb from hell, not once, not twice, but five times. Forget-me-not when your new awakened flower shall bloom.
Cool. All right, guys, so next we're going to go to Zoom for Massey's. Sorry, Ben, removing the mask in the background there. I hadn't caught that. Accessorized and everything, oiled up and ready to go. So we're going to go over to Zoom to Massimo. Massimo, how are you doing? What's the crack?
Hey, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful. Always an honor to be here. Thanks for having me. No more holy grail hunting. Worried if you don't avail at doing something stunning, then we'll say you failed at something. And maybe there's nobody but yourself that hails your coming. So don't be scared to just be frail and love someone or something, so that you can tell a tale that isn't based upon your suffering, but on the joy and love you bring. On the joy and love you bring. Different things we may have done may feel like different ones we've been, but the fact that we can change and stay the same is a wondrous thing. So grow to know yourself gradually and learn what makes you happy. Put the work in actively until it just comes naturally. Think about things practically until they happen magically. And if there's a glitch in the pattern, just make it part of the tapestry. To the squareness in our view, this life looks like a Rubik's Cube, but sometimes more like Play-Doh if the beauty is where it's misconstrued. Too curvy for perfect form and too funky for formula. So let the sliding scale slide your limbo to a utopia. I'm not saying just to sell out or settle out, just settle down. And give to yourself like there's enough of you to spread around. I'm not saying spend it up, lend it out, or pay it down. Just make it count without lifting more than your own weight just to save a pound. But enough with the uplifting. It's touching, but I just want to be done lifting. Done thinking wishfully about giving in or just quitting. Who's to say I'll be done living, even when I'm done kicking? But don't do as I do, listen, but don't listen. And don't do as I say, I'm not preaching, I'm just thinking. Just do what you're doing and I thank you for existing. Maybe there's no holy grail, only you and what's not missing. Peace and love, thank you all so much.
Always a pleasure to see you, Massimo. Fantastic, thank you for that. Okay, so I think we're all very excited for what's coming next. I'd like to welcome the man behind the mesh, the mad crusader, Benjamin Burns.
The philosopher Thomas Nagel has an essay called, it's a famous essay called What's It Like to Be a Bat? Where he's like wondering what it's like to be a bat. And then he argues that it's impossible to know what it's like to be a bat. And it's a brilliant essay, but I think it's a little bit pessimistic. Like, what's it like to be another person? Yeah? And then I've been watching bats and listening to bats and thinking about bats. And then I like they're flying. So this is a poem. This is called What Was It Like to Be a Bat Boy? Like linking my experience to what I kind of imagine about bats. It's also, I should say, like it's an ultrasonic piece, but I'm gonna slow down my performance in order to make it perceivable. At 10, I pedaled hard. I was a pipistrel with a red BMX for wings. I tore loops round the garden, cut corners, sprayed gravel, wore down grass. I was harried by invisible opponents, quick as light at the onset of night, quick as thought, or a bat who could execute wheelies with no wheels, force acrobatic adjustments mid-flight. I shouted and shouted at insects over sweet fuchsia rising who echoed code ended. who Echo Code ended on, my tongue crumpled wafers between teeth, thin air buffeting the underside of my ears and against the undersides of my palms like a pair of feeling kites, or the palms of two calloused hands still sore from clutching the handlebars' dotted grips.
Thank you so, so much, Ben. Tonight, again, Cork sleeps safely, thanks to Benjamin Burns. So our final poet this evening is Philip Spillane, and then we're going to head over to the Crane Lane, to Arthur Mayne's Wine Bar, for a aperitif, well, no, it's a nightcap. That's what we're looking for.
We should all cosplay as our poems. Thanks, my friend. I didn't want to go last, but all. And this is. All right. Sorry. A bad boy. Nice one, then. Well done. This is a project I've been working on for quite a while, and it's an abstract from my story, She Begs, She More. And I'm going to jump right into it, but I'm just going to say very briefly. So, Oisin and Danu leave Cork City into the fog. He climbed on the bike in front of Danu. She put her arms around his waist, her knees pressed against his body. Oisin kicked the engine and revved. It still works. And they drove into the fog. Oisin tore his bike like a stallion. The engine galloped, and when it picked up speed, he felt so free. They rode down the Glanmire Road, and only meters were illuminated ahead, and beyond that was a veil of dense fog. "Where are we going?" he shouted. Without a helmet, he felt the drizzle bouncing off his face. "Where it's foggiest, we want to get lost." The street was empty. Oisin was confused. He felt the stretch went on forever. River Lee was faithfully whispering on his right. He looked at the wind mirror, and it showed what they left behind had vanished. They were going faster, and faster, and faster, and faster, then bam! Nashin tried to keep his wheels still. Gradually, the bike slowed down. "What's happening?" "Not sure. There's something wrong with the engine." They stopped, and Nashin took out his phone. "There's no signal. There's a house. Maybe we should walk back. We couldn't have gone far." "Look, Oisin, it's the sea." Oisin looked around. The fog had begun to clear, and instead of the River Lee, it looked more like the open sea, all right. Big waves fighting around with one another. "Maybe the dam has released a lot of water. That does not look like the River Lee, Oisin." Dan was right, but Oisin pretended to not recognize the rocky shore. "What about the cottage?" Oisin looked the other way at the strange building, the straw roof with walls painted red, a complete mismatch. "Do you want to try there? Could be fun." They both got off the bike and together they dragged it to the footpath. Oisin tried to push start it, where Daniel went up to the door and knocked. A small man in a purple poncho answered. He had hard sideburns and deep, deep green eyes. "Yo, I'm Konas. How can I help you?" "Konas, I am Danu." "Ah, pleasure to meet you finally, Danu. Always wanted to meet someone like you," he winked. "And do I know you?" "I hope so," said the man. "Who's the boyfriend?" "That's Oisin, but he's not my boyfriend. We're stuck. The motorbike is broken." "Oh shit, sorry about that. May I ask, are you Danu of the land, as of Oisin the storyteller?" Danu smiled. "Yes, I am," she lied. Ah, Konas didn't believe her, and then he walked up to Oisin. "Is she banjaxed?" "I don't know what happened. Are we far from Cork?" "I don't know where that is," shrugged Konas. Then where are we? You're on my island.